I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Valerie Naranjo. She is a percussionist, vocalist, and composer. She plays percussion for NBC's Saturday Night Live band. She's recorded and performed with so many different people, the Lion King on Broadway, the Philip Glass Ensemble, David Byrne, Paul Winter Consort, Tony Amos, Ayrton Moreira, and many, many more. And she will be here this Saturday night in Santa Fe at the Rail Yard Performance Center for an event which is kind of a prelude to the Marimba Festival, which is happening in June. Welcome, Valerie, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much.
And Angela Gabriel joins us here in the cafe. She's a percussionist and marimba player and is also involved with the Marimba Festival. It's great to have you on the air.
Thanks.
So, Valerie, let's talk for a moment. How did you become a musician and a percussionist in particular?
I come from a family that honors music. We're from the Southern Ute tribe on my father's side, and my grandfather was known to be a person who got people together to play music in their home. So when I was a child, I sang, and actually I was probably about 7 years old before I realized that you didn't go to someone's house and have dinner and then automatically break out the instruments and start singing after about an hour or two. My mother actually wanted to be a percussionist, but she grew up at a time when, you know, women didn't necessarily do all the things that men did. And my grandfather, he dissuaded her out of his best interest and out of her best interest that he felt that being a woman in clubs and bars and places like that, you know, as a teenager would probably not be a good thing for her. So he dissuaded her from pursuing percussion. When I was 9 years old and decided upon, you know, really formal musical study, she persuaded me to try to play percussion. And I have a mom who's never wrong, who's very wise, and I gave it a try. She never told me, though, that she herself didn't have the opportunity. It was really well into my professional life that she mentioned one day that she herself had not had that opportunity. It took me a couple of years to catch on and catch the fever of drumming, but once I did, I never let go, and that's my beautiful, beautiful gift that my mother gave to me.
What a beautiful gift to give it to you and not have that pressure on you of, I couldn't do this, and so you have to do it. You just naturally fell into it. That's a lovely thing and an extra kind of gift.
Yes, I really, you know, it's just a kind of a legacy of part of the legacy of her wisdom and restraint when with, you know, raising the children and rearing the nieces and nephews that always came over and sought my parents' guidance and protection and support.
So then you also studied marimba. And I guess there's a lot of different kinds of marimba. How did you start, and how did your studies in marimba progress?
Well, I began formal music study in junior high school. Throughout high school, I entered the University of Colorado at Boulder under Professor John Gaum, who is just a wonderful, wonderful world music historian. He had contact with one of the doctoral students in the program who was from the southern part of Ghana, from the Eve Nation. And Ghana is known for its Eve drumming. So we were required to take a non-credit course with this gentleman, Joseph, in Eve drumming. It really opened my eyes to a lot of things, that those people who have a passion towards music don't necessarily, because of their studies, have the ability to communicate music, nor do they necessarily have the ability to make people dance. So he really awakened my awareness of really the mission that one has as a musician towards the rest of the community. And he used to walk up to a Western marimba. That's a chromatic marimba that's got the black and white keys the way a piano does. Of course, they're all colored, beautiful rosewood color. he would walk up to that Western instrument and play the most wonderful, gorgeous pieces of music. And the thing that impressed me about Joseph is that he had a sound. He got a sound out of the marimba that no one else I'd ever heard in my life. So I asked him, you know, where did you learn this? And he alluded to the Ghanaian djili, which is the grandmother of the Western marimba. I pursued Western marimba studies and actually transferred to the University of Oklahoma in Norman, where I met a gentleman named Lee Howard Stevens, who was championing an incredible new kind of technique that allowed marimbas to do things that they had never been able to do before. After studying with him for a week, I said, you know, I've got to keep doing this. What should I do? And his reply was, well, I live on 83rd and West End in Manhattan, so, and I have a studio of about 22 students, so why don't you come over? And I said, okay, let me complete my undergraduate studies. And in the following summer, I moved to Manhattan. I thought I'd be there for a year or two. But I studied with Lee for the rest of that year, continued with graduate studies with another wonderful marimbist named Gordon Stout in Ithaca, New York. I returned. By that time, I'd met my husband, who's also a wonderful musician, who will be joining me this Saturday. I returned to Manhattan, and I've been there ever since. It's been 30 and a half years.
Wow. And so you have this amazing story about going to Ghana as a highly accomplished marimba player and encountering a culture where women weren't allowed to play marimba. What happened?
Well, I went really on a leap of faith, because in 1988 I was busy traveling other continents, and you know, I had the fortune of being having the opportunity to travel a lot as a freelance musician. I had 3 weeks and 3 days that I could go to Ghana. I decided to go, take my chances. I ran immediately into all of the officers of the Ministry of Culture, which is a branch of the government in Ghana, because they are very concerned about the dissemination of dance, drama, song, and even culinary art, and definitely visual art. So I on the trip up to the part of Ghana that has the djili, which is the traditional marimba, I met all of these people, and they were going to a three-day-long festival called Kobine. And they were giving me lots of weird looks and asking me how I'd heard about the festival. And I said, well, no, I don't know anything about this festival, but I'm sure glad I ran into it. And they kind of took that as a sign that I really was supposed to be there. Ghanaians have a wonderful tradition that culture is something that brings people together. It allows them to release their emotions, their tensions. It allows them to bond, and it's absolutely necessary. Yes, it is entertainment, but it's also sound vibration, so that it's absolutely necessary to maintain culture in order to maintain the health of the community. And so this three-day festival, a pre-harvest festival called Kobine, is one of the big events in their life, in their year. I was trained by three djili masters at the same time. Sometimes they would actually sit together and train me, and they trained me for 3 days. Typically, when you go from the capital city to one of the villages, the first person that you visit is the chief of that village, because that chief is responsible for the well-being of the community. So they really operates under a truly democratic system where everyone has a say, but then there's someone with more experience and more wisdom who gives the final say. After 3 days of training, I was taken to the chief, Chief Carbeau, and he interviewed me, because there in that tradition there are three things that they have to be very careful about. In terms of a musician and their music, and that is the life condition of the musician, the life condition of the person who made the instrument, and the life condition of the person who created the song. So if any of those are tainted, or if anyone's trying to take advantage of the people rather than serve them and maintain balance, then the sound vibration itself is said to be impure and not allowed. So I seem to have passed that interview. Chief Garbeau asked me to return the following day with an instrument, and which I did, and seated around him, as there was the day before, was a council of elders, gentlemen who had a lot of experience, and they met daily at 5 o'clock p.m. to talk about the things that happened that day and to watch the sunset, basically. And I played for this council, and the place went into an uproar. They were arguing, and I asked my primary teacher, Baru, what's going on? What are they arguing about? Because they were arguing in the Dogara language so that I wouldn't understand their concerns. And they were talking about the fact that there were two traditions, and the traditions were in paradox. They were, do we let this person perform in our Kobane festival and honor the tradition that we must aid any foreign person who comes and wants to help us disseminate our culture, or do we not allow her to play and honor the tradition that women don't play the djili? And Chief Garbeau stood up in the middle of the argument and said in English so that I could understand, basically, because they all spoke English. He said, from now on, women are going to play the djili. So, of course, most people were, the gentlemen there were, there was a mixture of joy and anger, because some men didn't like that idea. And a couple of days after, I performed publicly, so that was a very exciting event, because then from that time forward to the present day, women have been coming to me, Ghanaian women, and saying, you know, that they too really had the desire to play, but they had not felt that they had the permission. So I, you know, before my first trip, I've been there 14 or 15 times now, and I make it a part of every year, every summer. But particularly during that first trip, I, you know, knew about people who went to Ghana and Burkina Faso and other countries and, you know, paid their money for their lessons and learned this treasure of music and basically left nothing for the community. And my prayer was to be able to do something that could be left, you know, that could leave something positive for the community. So that was really the answer to that, you know, to that prayer. And also kind of an affirmation that, you know, when I first began to go to Ghana, people were telling me, you're crazy, what are you doing? But I went nonetheless. And it really affirmed to me that, you know, when you follow your heart and do what you think is right for your life, you're probably going to affect some kind of change.
So now, in this same place where you were in Ghana, in this region of Ghana, women, girls are learning the marimba as children. They're becoming proficient players.
Yes, there are a number of women who play very, very well. One who was a second place winner in a similar festival to Kobane the following year. So all we can imagine is that she had been playing in secret, because it's playing the Ghanaian marimba is not something that you learn in a year. It really takes most adults a good part of their life to master. And she, placing second, you know, she had been studying and had been playing for quite a while. And similarly, last year at the Kakube Festival, which is a similar festival to Kobane, a woman placed, I believe, third in the competition for the best player, which is a really fierce and lovely competition where people are judged according to their repertoire and according to how they can move your heart with their music.
Extraordinary. I wish we had competitions where it was about how they could move your heart. What an amazing thing to have as a kind of criterion. It's almost like our culture needs that.
Yes, we do. We do need to have our hearts addressed, our heart health, you know, our emotional, spiritual health. I think things are moving in that direction. I've been very, very enheartened to Well, actually, I began teaching at the at New York University last semester in September, specifically the Geely, and specifically in the manner that Ghanaians teach one another. And they are taught in the family structure. So, you know, you have your room, board, and tuition is all taken care of. You have your master teacher who lives in your house, is probably your grandfather or your grandmother, and all of the arts, not only music, but textile, culinary arts, silversmithing. All of those arts are passed from mother to daughter or from father to son. And so this is a very big and wonderful experiment at New York University to be able to teach 19 percussion majors without the use of music and in a manner that is done in the village. So in that sense, there's always a person with more experience who gives advice and gives the information, but then it's up to the young students to teach one another. And then when there's a question, they go back to the maestro and the maestro irons out that situation. So it's really a situation where people, and this is a very, very complicated and beautiful art, the marimba in Ghana. It's not easy. So children, even at the age of 3 or 4, have to figure out these very complicated themes and conversation, musical conversations among one another. And then they go to the master musician and get guidance. Then they come back together and teach one another. And so to see, you know, the young people in New York who are basically from the age of 18 to 22, to see them doing this is, you know, it's really enheartening for me to see that it works as well with Americans as it does with Ghanaians.
Do you still have this? You talked earlier about this idea of playing not only to play but to make people dance. Is that still part of the way you think about music?
Oh, absolutely. The Geely, the Ghanaian marimba, in the olden times, whatever that might mean, and you know, I've been given this information from very old players in their 70s and 80s, they say that the instrument was once used to diagnose and treat psychological illness. And the way that they diagnosed was to play for a person, watch them dance, and find out what might be wrong, and then through dance, they would be healed through guided dance. Dance is it's an art in our country that is being marginalized, I guess I might say, in the same manner that I feel that live music is being marginalized. Not that it's disappearing necessarily, but if we're not careful, we could tend to regard this as not a necessity, a fringe, an entertainment, something that we do if we have time or a free day once a month. In traditional societies, not only in Ghana and in the Americas, but in this country, dance was something that was necessary, even if it was once a week. That people get together and dance, move their body, and improve their emotional health, if nothing else. But, you know, documentation tells that even our lymph node system is improved through constant movement, the kind of exact kind of movement that dance is. So as often as I can, I like to promote that and get students to dance. And in my performances, I ask the audience to dance, not only to dance, but to sing, because the art of song, like the art of dance, has been marginalized. I think since the advent of recorded music, you don't necessarily have to be in the presence of a musician to be able to dance and to be able to sing. You know, we can consume music from wonderful recordings, and the quality of recording is ever improving. But even in our, even in Colorado, we once had a culture that had a musician, and you know, even if it wasn't a professional, someone in the family or in the community structure who could provide music, live music, for the rest of us to dance. Yeah, I think it would be lovely if we could go back to that, because embedded in that tradition is an energetic release, a way to bond with other people, a non-linguistic way to just be together and show our love.
Yeah.
And that's a healthy thing.
Angela Gabriel, you are one of the people who's organizing and promoting the Marimba Festival in June, which we'll talk about more when we get closer to June. But tell us about the event this weekend.
Well, the event is a promotional event, so it's free. And, of course, Valerie's coming, which we're all excited about.
Yes,
and
indeed.
Akeem is, and his drummers and dancers. And then also Jaka is playing. They play Zimbabwean-style kind of Afro-funk, we call it. And so I'll be playing with Jaka. And so it's a dance party, community building. It's really a way to get people to be aware of what's happening in June with the festival.
Well, we're really looking forward to it. And Angela, we'll have to have you on the air another time to talk more about your own life and your own music. But it's great to have had you both on the air. Valerie Naranjo, percussionist, vocalist, composer, has played with some of the greatest musicians in the world. Her website is mandaramusic.com, MANDARA music.com. Angela Gabriel, percussionist, marimba player. Thank you both so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
I'm very happy now to welcome back to the program Orlando Leibovitz, and he is here to tell us about an event that's coming up this Friday at Santa Fe Complex. Welcome, Orlando.
Hi, thanks for having me on the program.
So the Chatter Chamber Ensemble, is that a local Santa Fe-based group?
Albuquerque-based group, composed of a number of really fine musicians. They performed last year. We had an event at the complex called Notions of Time, and they performed the Messiaen piece. They're a wonderful chamber orchestra.
And so this year you're doing a piece by Steve Reich and a piece by Arnold Schoenberg.
Correct. The program is called Counterpoint, and the two pieces are starting with Steve Reich's Different Trains, brief intermission, and then Arnold Schoenberg's Transfigured Night.
Now, these are two pieces that both have very interesting backstories.
Oh, yes. The stories behind them are part of the fascination that I have, and I hope that people will have for them. Different Trains was composed by Steve Reich in approximately 1986 to 88. And when he was a young boy, he's about 75 now, preeminent American composer. When he was a little boy in the late 30s and early 40s, his mother and father separated. His father was a New York lawyer. His mother was a pretty famous songwriter in Hollywood. And he was sent back and forth by train with his governess. Fast forward to, that's 1939, 1940, 41, 42. Fast forward to 1986, 88, when he's writing this piece, he realized that if he were a young Jewish boy in Europe during that period of time, he would have been on a different train, on a Holocaust train to a death camp. And so the music took on a tremendous meaning for him. And it's in three parts, America before the war, Europe during the war, and after the war. And the second and third part have a lot to do with the Holocaust and with the death and destruction that the Nazis perpetrated on Jews and other people.
And this is a piece where if you know the backstory, then you can kind of imagine those historical periods in the music somehow.
They're embedded in very much in the music. As a matter of fact, I have a very brief quote from Reich about different trains where he says, if different trains work, it is because documentary and musical reality are one and the same. Not only that, but he interviewed his governess, who was still alive, a Pullman porter, and three Holocaust survivors. And the music from the piece comes partially from taking snippets of their voices and actually tracing the pitch of their voice and creating a melody from the pitch of their voice. So the music comes directly out of the storyline, not just by virtue of inspiration, but also by virtue of how the melodies got started. In the piece are the voices of these people. There are sirens, there are bells, there are whistles. It's a live performance with a performance tape. So there's a quartet playing live, but in addition, the sounds are coming from a tape that's been pre-recorded, and on the pre-recording is another quartet playing. So the live quartet's playing against the pre-recorded quartet and these bells and whistles and sounds.
Orlando, why don't we hear a little snippet of different trains by Steve Reich? This is from the second part here.
Yeah, part two is during the war.
Excellent. Let's hear that right now.
Quick, go. Don't breathe. Don't breathe.
Into the start of the war. Into the start of the war. For 4 days and 4 nights.
And that was just a little piece of Different Trains by Steve Reich, which is part of the evening called Counterpoint, which is happening at Santa Fe Complex this Friday at 7 o'clock. We're talking to Orlando Leibovitz. Now, the other piece is Schoenberg's Transfigured Night, and that also has an interesting story.
Oh, it has an amazing story. One thing I want to interject for folks who have come to the complex but haven't been there for the past few months, that we've moved from the building that was behind the rail yard to the Second Street Studios. So it's 1807 Second Street, not the old building.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. I wouldn't want people to wind up going to the old building.
You're at 1807 Second Street.
1807 Second, right.
Is it across from the former Cloud Cliff, the El Patio restaurant?
If you're heading towards Cerritos Road on 2nd Street, you get to Back Road Pizza.
Uh-huh.
If you make a right into Back Road Pizza and go to the first driveway, this complex building is on the right.
Okay, so it's
side.
On the same side as Back Road Pizza and El Patio.
Yes.
Okay. Excellent. Well, that's very good to know, because that was a great building.
It was a great building. There were a number of issues involved, which are not worth getting into phone, but on the radio.
Yeah. All right, so let's talk about Schoenberg's Transfigured Night.
Well, Schoenberg is a seminal figure in 20th century music, and I have not seen this anywhere else, but my own take on it is that Schoenberg, shortly after, 8 or 10 years after composing Transfigured Night, did for music what Picasso did in painting and what Braque did in painting. He totally reordered things. The Cubist threw out perspective and did a number of other things to radically change the way painting was done, and Schoenberg did the same thing, but in music. But this piece takes place in 1898, composed in 1898. He's just at the point of becoming what's called atonal in his music, but he's not quite there yet. And the piece is based on a poem by a poet, Richard Demel. And the poem is also called Transfigured Night. It's a fascinating story, poem of two lovers who are walking through a wood on a grove on a moonlit night, and the woman feels compelled to tell her newfound lover that prior to meeting him, she was depressed and unhappy and felt that if she had a child, things would be better. And so she basically had sex with a stranger, and now I've met you. And she is waiting in anticipation for his response. His response, amazingly enough, is, "This child will be as though it were my child. It will transfigure you, transfigure me, and transfigure the night." It's a pretty dramatic poem that touches on a lot of what was going on in Vienna at the time. Both of these pieces, by the way, Mary Charlotte, are accompanied by the world premiere of videos that we have commissioned for each piece. So there'll be a video for Different Trains and a separate video for the Schoenberg piece. The poem of the Schoenberg piece is set in a grove on a moonlit night, and the moon follows the lovers as they're talking, and the video that we've commissioned from a Swiss artist, Michael Spahr, is simply that. It's very minimalistic nighttime scene, and the moon moves across the sky from left to right as the poem progresses. It starts rising when the music begins and ends when the music ends. The video for Different Trains by Asha Tamarisa is an extraordinarily interesting, abstract piece of flashing, blinking work that I think becomes a musical visual instrument. I think that the whole visual of it reflects the tense, anxious, mournful music that Reich has created. So I hope that other people feel the same when they see them.
Should we listen now to a little clip from Transfigured Night?
Yeah, that would be great.
All right, let's do that. That was a clip from the piece Transfigured Night by Arnold Schoenberg, which is part of the evening Counterpoint, which once again is this coming Friday, the 23rd of March, at 7 in the evening. The Chatter Chamber Ensemble from Albuquerque, and it's at Santa Fe Complex, which once again is at its new location at 1807 Second Street.
1807 Second Street, number 107. And
Will there be signs and stuff on the street so you can find it?
We may have a sign out where Back Road Pizza is, and we'll maybe have a person where the building is. This space is a smaller space than our previous one, so we have a seating capacity of 80 people. If people are interested, I recommend they go to the Santa Fe Complex website, sfcomplex.org, and follow the link to Eventbrite. You can guarantee a seat by buying a ticket in advance.
Oh, okay. And if people want more information, let's say they can go to sfcomplex.org.
Yeah.
And is there a number they can call?
There is a number. I recommend that they go to the link instead and get information that way.
Okay.
I'm not sure how available the number is going to be for information.
All right. Orlando Leibovitz is an artist and is organizer of this evening Counterpoint Friday night.
Oh, I wanted to mention one other thing. I'm the co-curator of this event with Jason Goodyear, who is a sound, a visual artist, and an educator, and this would not have taken place without Jason's participation.
Excellent. Orlando, thanks for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
I'd like now to welcome back to the show Jackie Fleming. She's founder of the Cimarron Sky Dog Wild Horse Sanctuary. Welcome, Jackie.
Hi.
It's good to have you back. We wanted a year in town, so we just thought we'd get you on the air for a bit for an update of what's happening at the Wild Dog. Wild Dog. Wild Horse Sanctuary. Sky Dog is a Native American name
for
horses.
Yes. Well, an old Native American name for a horse.
But you have a sanctuary for wild horses.
Yes.
And it's a continual struggle to have enough space and enough land and enough grazing area for your horses.
Yes. I mean, if you know, we want our horses to be running free and grazing and not having to be supplemented if possible. And out here in this arid climate, that requires a lot of land. You know, other parts of America, of course, it's where it rains more, then, you know, you don't need quite so much land. But out here in the high desert, you need a lot of land. And we're lucky right now, we're leasing 1,000 acres and we have 420 acres of our own. But that lease, you know, doesn't belong to us and the land is for sale. So at any minute, we could lose that lease and then most of our horses would have to come back and stand in corrals.
Oh, no.
Mm-hmm. And so we're trying desperately to find a way to be able to, what I call, secure that land. It doesn't mean that we have to own it, but we're hoping that somebody else might come along and buy it and let us use it for grazing.
Right.
Because we are a 501c3 nonprofit, so there would be some incentives there.
Oh, that's interesting. So, ladies and gentlemen, if if anybody is listening right now who is interested in buying some land and not developing it and let horses run wild on it, that would be wonderful.
Yes, and there's a lot of land around us for sale. It's not just the lease. There's land all around us. It used to be a 10,000-acre ranch that got subdivided.
Where are you? Where is it?
It's up at Watrous, which is just north of Las Vegas, New Mexico.
Oh, okay.
And it's right on the Santa Fe Trail. It's very historic land. There's wagon ruts that run right through it. And it's...
I can't believe that wagon ruts last 100 years.
Well, they're
more
eroded. I mean, you know, these are almost trenches at this point.
Yeah.
Because they act as kind of arroyos over the years and the water runs through. And now they're just big trenches. But I'm such a history buff, I get such a kick out of it. But
yeah.
It's also completely unspoiled land. It's, you know, it's had ranches out there, but really it's not been changed very much since, God, thousands of years maybe. And it's a wildlife refuge, basically. There's
and probably a wildlife corridor for migrating animals.
Oh, definitely. I know the elk use it. They go back and forth in huge numbers back and forth through there. So we'd hate to see houses going up and more fences going up because that's not only ugly, but it interferes with the movement of the wildlife to keep putting more and more fences up. So we really hope that we can find a way to do two things, preserve the land and have a place for our horses, in limited numbers, of course, because we don't want to be guilty of overgrazing. And it's very easy to do if there's drought or anything like that, you know. And for year-round grazing, since the grass doesn't grow year-round, you know, you have to have enough grass that's going to see them through the winter without them grazing it down to dirt.
Well, how has the winter been for the horses?
It's been pretty mild. We had a good December. We had rain and snow that stuck around for 3 weeks up there. January was very mild. We've had a few snowfalls in February. But it's really the spring that we're hoping is going to be a bonanza because that's when the grass starts to want to grow. And it won't unless we get rain. It can stay dormant for months if...
Right. And so it's really, I mean, there's probably a formula for this. The amount of rainfall per month is proportional to the amount, to the number of horses you can graze on an acre of land.
Well, I don't know. I haven't heard it in that kind of formula. I've heard it more that out here in this climate, it should be about 60 to 70 acres per horse.
Wow.
For year-round grazing.
Whereas back east or in a place where there's a lot more rain, you don't need nearly that many acres per horse.
It's a handful of acres.
Yeah.
And plus the grass is growing in most of those places year-round. I'm English and it's green year-round.
Yeah.
Whereas everyone comes out and sees our horse is standing out in brown grass, and they go, oh my God, it's so brown. It's like, because the grass is dormant. Like, it just, it's warm weather grass. It doesn't grow when it's freezing cold. So
how many horses do you have now?
30. We have 30 horses.
And where did they come from?
Well, some are from the Forestry Service in New Mexico. So we've got a good group of New Mexico Mustangs. And then we have Mustangs that I've adopted from the BLM, and they come from Wyoming, Nevada, and Utah. Just got one from Utah in January. And so they're a mixed bag.
And do they all, I mean, you have to introduce all these horses to each other. Do they all kind of form a family?
Well, they are now. I mean, obviously the new guy always has to go through hell. They go through the pecking order and the fights then. And of course, horses, you know, they can be petty. They can have their petty squabbles like any family can. But generally, once they have established themselves as a herd, they pretty much get along and are pretty bonded. And I'd like for them to stay together for the rest of their lives. We don't adopt our horses out because,
right. You
know, some of them have been through, you know, years at BLM pens being moved from place to place to place. And then, of course, initially they were separated from their wild herd. And so when they come to us, we really hope that that's the end of the journey for them and the friends.
So they've been traumatized.
Some. I mean, I'm not going to say all treatment to BLM horses is bad. And I know the Forestry Service horses were treated very well because I saw that firsthand. And the Forestry Service horses I have were not rounded up by helicopters. They were rounded up with a bait and trap system. So they didn't go through the same experience as BLM horses. But I've got some horses that you corner them and they go ballistic, and others, they're just fine about it. They're not happy about it, but they don't panic. And so the ones that really, really panic to the point of they would rather be dead, you think, well, that's got to have come from an experience that left them not liking to be put back in that. Because we have a chute if we have to give shots or worming and things like that, or feet. People are always asking us how we do that. We have a chute that we can put them in, and most of them tolerate it, and we get the job done without the horses getting hurt and without the people getting hurt. But we, you know, last year I got 3 from BLM pens, and we put them in the chute, and it was awful.
Yeah.
We nearly lost 2 of them. They would just panic to the point of just about killing themselves, and we were like, never again. They're never going in there again.
Yeah.
You know, and they had been in the BLM pens for 3 years each. So,
well, that's its own trauma.
Yeah.
If you're a wild horse.
Well, especially on the adoption.
It's like prison.
Well, they're on the adoption circuit. These weren't long-term holding horses. So these guys were moved around from adoption site to adoption site. So their whole life was about being put from one pen to this, to be in a truck, into this, to that, and constantly being moved around.
Why weren't they just left on the land where they were wild in the first place? Why are they being rounded up?
Well, because, you know, it's about numbers and how many horses the land can sustain. And the BLM says there's way too many horses that for the land to sustain. And so they've been their way of controlling the numbers has been to round them up and put them up for adoption. But there are close to 50,000 Mustangs standing around in BLM pens. So that system's obviously not working and hasn't been working for a long time. And so it's about numbers, but the argument is that, you know, there's millions of domestic animals, i.e. cows and sheep, grazing on the same land. There's less than 30,000 wild horses left and millions of cattle and sheep. Doesn't even make sense to blame the horses for overgrazing at this stage, you know. And then, of course, there's a new competitor for the land, and that's the extractive industries, which is oil and gas and uranium. And they are coming into that country with a vengeance. I mean, it's a boom. And there are hundreds of thousands of oil and gas wells out there now.
And so the BLM wants to make that land. Well, I mean, if they're clearing horses for oil and gas, are they also clearing cows?
Well, I don't know where that stands right now. It doesn't seem like it, but, you know.
Interesting.
It's, you know, the damage done. I mean, I've been to the Jicarilla Wild Horse Territory in northern New Mexico, where they have, it's Forestry Service land, and they have wild horses out there. And there are over 900 wells, gas wells, out there. And they are bringing the horses down to 100. And, you know, it's a network of roads and well pads and pump jacks and generators pounding away all night long. And to continue...
So it's not a place for animals.
Well, to continue to blame the horses for any, you know, damage done to public lands at this point, it's, you know, it's not even true. And I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but logically it doesn't even make any sense. So...
So we're talking to Jackie Fleming of the Cimarron Sky Dog Wild Horse Sanctuary. So the call out today is, if there are people there who would like to actually buy some land in that area, Watrous, north of Las Vegas, New Mexico, they could get in touch with you and you could form some kind of collaboration.
Yes, I can put them in touch with the people who are selling it to and representing it. I mean, there's another thing, there's another option. You can buy the land and put it into New Mexico Land Conservancy, so you're conserving the land and preventing it from further subdivision. And there's some serious tax benefits from doing that, which are sellable and transferable, so they don't have to even be used in New Mexico. You could use them in a place where, you know, property taxes are way higher than here, and and you can if you don't need them, you can actually sell them, and so you would be looking at, you know, you'd have an land investment, you would have something you could sell for that or keep for yourself if you've got land somewhere else and your property taxes are really high, and then there would be some tax incentives for allowing a nonprofit to use it, you know, for grazing. And like I said, we'd be limited numbers. We're not out to have thousands of horses, and we don't breed. We don't have stallions. We don't breed our horses. We would prefer.
So they're all neutered or spayed or whatever it's called.
Gelded. The males are gelded.
Okay.
And so it's not something where there's somebody's got good intentions, and next thing they know, 3 years from now, their horses have horse herd is expanded to the point that they can no longer.
Right.
Control it, and that has happened with, you know, people that have not kept the breeding under control. We would prefer that if there's a space for a horse to come live at our sanctuary, that we get one out of a pen. We don't breed one.
Exactly. Because there's some, but as you said, there's 50,000 horses.
Well, coming up, it's 47,000 was the last number I heard.
Oh,
and that's. That, you know, with less than 30,000 left in the wild, most of America's wild horses are standing in pens now.
Amazing.
And the roundups continue. So,
Jackie Fleming is the founder of the Cimarron Sky Dog Wild Horse Sanctuary. How can people get in touch with you?
Well, they can get us through our website, which is cimarronskydog.org, and Cimarron spelt with two R's and one M.
Oh, I had it spelled wrong.
I know.
Cimarron.
Yes. Yeah, Cimarron.
Cimarron.
Yes.
Skydog.org.
Yes. And my email, you can get me on my email, and the phone number's on there as well. I mean, I can give the phone number on the radio. It's 505-473-9598.
Excellent.
And, you know, there's lots from 140 acres to 1,000 acres and more for sale up there. And, you know, we would really love to see that land just stay wild.
Stay in conservation for so many reasons. Well, Jackie, thank you for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much for having me.